This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
A special welcome to Radio EcoShock London on Resonance 104.4 FM. I'm Alex Smith, bringing you weekly voices from the emerging world crisis. Climate change, peak oil, populations, species going extinct, degraded soil and water, an economy in trouble, a society in a challenged state, and what we can do about it. We cover the world, broadcasting on 48 stations on three continents. This week, it's the upcoming Conference of the Polluters in Durban, South Africa. After the disappointments of Copenhagen and Cancun, does anyone really care? But we do not have the luxury of despair, as rising greenhouse gases threaten everything we know and coming generations. The real show at Durban, officially known as COP17, the Conference of the Parties, is what happens outside the gathering of world leaders and their industrial supporters. In this program, you will hear the other voices. Directly from South Africa, Professor Patrick Bond lays out the awful truth, where climate talks have gone into the dead zone, and the climate justice movement is there to change all that. I ask him if it will be safe to protest in Durban. Through the World Development Movement, you will hear two more from Durban. Bandile Medelose is General Secretary of a Shack Dwellers Movement in KwaZulu-Natal. And from the South Durban Community Environmental Alliance, campaigner Bongani Mthembu explains what everyone from Occupy London knows, what you already know, about corporate control of our governments. From London, Murray Worth of WDM explains the recent Durban activist tour and expectations for the coming climate conference. Learning from the exclusion of activists in Copenhagen, environment groups are working to empower youth from developing countries using new media. In San Francisco, we'll talk to Madeline Kovacs of Project Survival Media about youth media teams coming to Durban from India, Kenya, and more. It is your planet. Tune in to the Climate Underground, soon to erupt in the mainstream, with Radio EcoShock.
This is Radio EcoShock.
Thank heavens the Copenhagen Climate Conference failed and the other conferences haven't gone anywhere. That's the view of our next guest, Patrick Bond, perhaps. He's a professor at the University of KwaZulu-Natal and director of the Center for Civil Society there. Dr. Bond has worked for the South African government, especially in the reconstruction program. He advises several international journals and has a history of civil rights activism. Patrick just returned to Durban from a European conference and lecture tour. Professor Bond, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks so much for having me, Alex. Good to be with you.
Well, before we get to the upcoming Durban climate meeting known as COP17, let us handle some of the previous business. In late 2009, many climate activists in Europe and North America were crushed by the failure to find a meaningful agreement. They wanted Copenhagen to happen, and it didn't. Similarly at Cancun, why should we not feel that way?
Well, I think, Alex, that there was a mixed view from the environmentalists and more mainstream, let me call them Climate Action Network, where they were crushed, as you said, and that's because they had expectations that in spite of very adverse balance of forces at the global scale, that Copenhagen could, as they put it, seal the deal. And that was a deal that they anticipated generating from the Kyoto Protocol a global carbon market. And from that, an anticipation that you could use the market solution to solve the market problem. And that's the ideology of a certain kind of large environmental NGO that's often tied up with corporate capital. And environmentalists haven't thought through very much about whether markets really would work, given that they're really chaotic. So the climate justice movement, in contrast, wasn't really surprised and wasn't disappointed by Copenhagen, because had Copenhagen in December 2009 delivered a real deal, it would have actually set back the efforts to solve the problem, because it would have generated what we call false solutions. And the carbon market's the most extreme. And, of course, for Canada, it's complicated, because all the political parties more or less either deny there's a climate problem or promote this market solution. But I think you'd find this climate justice movement, your listeners will not look too far to find major figures associated with it, people like Naomi Klein or Maud Barlow or Tony Clark, and major indigenous environmental activist Ben Paulus, and lots of folks who have really thought through and found that these Copenhagen-type solutions that were being proposed, as well as the next year in Cancun, really won't work. So not really disappointment, a commitment to go back to places like the tar sands and do direct action and raise issues in a much more direct way, since the global leaders simply can't.
And the World Bank was tossed into that. All the money was going to go through the World Bank.
Yeah, that certainly came up in Cancun the next year, that is last December, and that was a shocking development, because the World Bank was the institution most aggressively expanding its lending on fossil fuels. In South Africa, we were the main victim, in fact, with the third largest coal-fired power plant in the world, what's called Medupi, by the Eskom Power Company, funded by the World Bank, its biggest ever project loan, $3.75 billion U.S. And those indications, especially of the president of the World Bank, named Robert Zoellick, that he would just continue corporate-oriented climate management, such as even privatizing not just the forests, but even the charismatic species, as he called it, big animals within the forest, also very clear in Cancun. So this year, in 2011, we've been making quite a big effort to, say, get the World Bank out of the climate financing game. And unfortunately, given this adverse balance of forces, the World Bank stands to continue as a trustee of what might be a $100 billion a year fund, the largest such fund ever generated, promised by Hillary Clinton in Copenhagen, which is meant to be addressing the climate crisis. And of course, if you've got the World Bank in there, it's simply going to make it worse. I think that's a fairly obvious conclusion.
Do you expect to see a real solution coming out of COP17 as it's held in Durban?
No, the COP17 will be dead space, a cul-de-sac, a conference of polluters. But what would come out, I'm quite convinced, having talked so much now with the local activists here in Durban and those that will be visiting, is a sense that since the global elites are simply not addressing the problem, and they haven't really addressed any major problem in the world since the Montreal Protocol in 1987 that dealt with the ozone hole, that was a chlorofluorocarbon ban. CFCs are no longer made in our deodorants or refrigerators. And that's the last time we've seen the right kind of solution to ban a very dangerous pollutant. And of course, greenhouse gases are very dangerous pollutants. We need to eventually stop generating any greenhouse gases, and especially carbon dioxide, and we need to get off fossil fuels. The global elites, on the other hand, think that a variety of false solutions, carbon trading and geoengineering and nuclear and all sorts of wacky schemes are going to be sufficient, and they're just not willing to make the major emissions cuts and pay the climate debt from the North owes the South, and to set up the tribunals we're going to need to punish those like the United States and Canada that continue to pollute beyond their legitimate share. And so I think we'll have climate injustice inside the COP17, and we'll have climate justice outside saying, no, there's a better way, which is following, again, these Indigenous Environmental Network activists in Alberta and the environmentalists that are allied with them, to leave the tar sand in the land and leave the coal in the hole and leave the oil in the soil and leave the fracking gas and whatever you want to rhyme with that. And those are the kinds of immediate solutions to stopping fossil fuel extraction while we move into a transition to a much different society, much different economy.
And you've also raised the problem of intellectual property and compared it with the very controversial subject of AIDS. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, Alex, it's a very interesting precedent that from below, from activists here in Durban, South Africa, where we started really in the year 2000 with the AIDS conference, there was a treatment action campaign that got allied support from the U.S., from Canada, from Europe. Those were the main sites of struggle against big pharmaceutical companies and the U.S. and European governments. And the main terrain that we ultimately won on was the World Trade Organization's trade-related intellectual property system, TRIPS. And in that system, basically a big company in the North America or Europe can simply put a 20-year monopoly patent on even a life-saving medicine and just keep it out of anyone's hands. Here in South Africa, it costs $15,000 a year to get the AIDS medicines to allow people to live, 5.5 million people who are HIV positive. So the crucial need in the year 2001 was in Doha, where the World Trade Organization surrendered intellectual property rights so that AIDS medicines could be made generically without those provisions of monopoly profits to some few big companies. And then in 2003 in South Africa, the South African government finally turned around after lots of protest against the Mbeki government, and very soon there were generic medicines made. So we really need to get that sort of precedent, an emergency life-saving strategy for getting the clean technology patents lifted and general use of, for example, new solar technologies and wind and wave and tidal and those sorts of technologies that we don't simply haven't developed here in South Africa, but places like Germany or Japan, they have been developing. And I think that's going to be crucial to solving the problem by getting out of the fossil fuel and into the renewable markets for the technologies. And, of course, it won't really happen through markets. It's going to have to be major state investments because the private sector doesn't find the profits really yet to do this. So we're going to really need major subsidies and bottom-up strategies to get more community control of these technologies as well.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with Professor Patrick Bond from the University of KwaZulu-Natal in Durban, South Africa. Durban is the site of the next conference of the parties, known as COP17, starting November 28, 2011. It is the grand gathering of the countries of the world under the United Nations trying to prevent serious climate change here on planet Earth. I see that South Africa, Patrick, is set to release its own climate action plan at the Durban conference. How is your country doing when it comes to controlling greenhouse gas emissions?
Well, quite disastrously. The ruling bloc here really isn't interested in cutting back. In fact, this is why the third and the fourth largest coal-fired power plants in the world are being built now. Those are plants that each of them will be polluting more, 25 to 30 million tons of CO2 a year than 115 countries do. So we're looking at a disaster on the scale of, well, you know, it's just extraordinary expansion of our fossil fuel industry. You'd say, well, how could that be if you're also hosting this conference? And it's because the big smelters, the big mining houses have extraordinary power, and they set up 40-year-long deals at the end of apartheid. So we're still in the middle of that, in which they get electricity about 2 cents a kilowatt hour. That's even cheaper than Canada. That's the cheapest in the world. And meanwhile, to pay for these huge plants, the ordinary people are being taxed massively, and over 100% increase in the electricity price in the last 2-3 years. So that means huge disconnections and massive protests are rising, but huge struggles over whether people are connected or disconnected or illegally reconnected. Now, that's the sort of terrain in which the South African government is really having to pretend that it's sort of to greenwash, that it's going to put out some sort of responsible climate plan. And all indications from all of the expansion of petrochemicals here where I live in South Durban to these coal-fired plants to the sports tourism strategy here in Durban, where we just built about $3-4 billion worth of new stadiums last year for the World Cup. So it's an extraordinary fib, and I don't think anyone will be fooled, because South Africa does look, we are the most unequal major country in the world, and there's a real energy apartheid, and no one can fail to notice that the townships are seething with anger, with people being disconnected while these big companies get the cheapest electricity in the world. So it's a bit of a sham, the idea that South Africa is serious about the climate.
And two big polluters, Sasol and Eskom, I believe it's called, are on South Africa's COP17 negotiating committee, right there on the committee.
It's extraordinary, and indeed, not only them, but the National Business Initiative has a chief executive who will be on that committee, who was a climate negotiator. And according to the head of the G77 delegation in Copenhagen, Lumumba Diaping, she was very involved in splitting Africa up and weakening Africa. So I think there's a lot of impatience about South Africa's role. I think it, like Canada's, perhaps you could call it sub-imperialist. It really goes with the big imperial blocks for the sake particularly of its own fossil fuel industry. And indeed, as I said, the largest companies, Anglo-American, used to be South African, now London, or BHP Billiton used to be South African, now Australian. Those are the companies that are benefiting. So it's not even like the profits are staying in South Africa. They're scooting off to London and Melbourne. And those are the sort of politics of elites that give you some indication that you know, all of these negotiating teams, Harper's as well as the U.S. and all, are just going there to increase their own emissions as much as they can. They're not interested in the genuine 50% cuts we're going to need by 2020 to begin to really move towards the 1 to 1.5 degree level ambitions that we're going to have to stop mass extinction.
Well, if it all goes wrong, and perhaps I should say when it all goes wrong, what have you heard about serious intentions to use geoengineering to moderate the climate?
Yeah, those are just such wacky plans. And at one of the major UN conferences last year in Japan, they were very much discouraged. And, of course, the story out recently was from London, where some British scientists were going to be doing some cloud seeding experiments with vapor. And luckily, those were postponed because of the uproar. So I think the geoengineering, I certainly would listen to the great Canadian analyst Pat Mooney and his colleagues in the ETC group, who've got a new book out about the dangerous land grab. It also extends to things like, you know, dropping iron filings in the ocean to create algae blooms, or the huge biofuel strategies that are creating major land grabs here in Africa. So these are the sorts of things that have to be stopped. And there is very strong resistance all around, and hopefully there won't be a great deal many more of these, and we can really get to the more genuine solutions, like the emissions cuts that are needed and leaving the fossil fuels in the ground and really rapidly transforming not just the sort of production and energy and transport system, but also our excessive Western consumption systems as well.
As we all know, the European Union is under tremendous financial stress. Europe was considered a leader in renewable energy and funding safe energy proposals. Now that all seems in doubt. Could you talk to us about the impact of a possible economic crash on climate negotiations?
Well, it has especially soured the notion that Durban would generate a climate finance deal. And in the preparatory negotiations recently in Cape Town, it seemed that especially the U.S., which, of course, made the $100 billion promise, Hillary Clinton came to Copenhagen dangling that bait. And, of course, as we've known from WikiLeaks, thank goodness for Bradley Manning, the brave U.S. Army lieutenant who released all that 500,000 cables to Julian Assange and WikiLeaks, we know that the main negotiator from the U.S., whose name is Todd Stern, his underling, Jonathan Pershing, are absolutely committed to bribing, bullying, cajoling, blackmailing. They used $50 million, for example, to try to buy the Maldives, and then they succeeded to get them to support the Copenhagen Accord, or pulling back several million dollars from Ecuador and Bolivia for not supporting the Copenhagen Accord. These are the kinds of things that mean not just, I'd say, Todd Stern, Jonathan Pershing, Hillary Clinton, Barack Obama, the Washington crew, Robert Zoellick, the World Bank president, should stay away from Durban, but probably we'd say the same about Ottawa officials as well. So hoping to make sure that the Canadian government, like the U.S., doesn't come to, and I'd say many in the Europeans, the main European strategy, Connie Hedegaard, the minister there, has made it fairly clear. They want to keep the Kyoto Protocol's carbon trading, but not extend its binding commitments to make emissions cuts. So I think, in fact, if these delegations from Brussels, Ottawa, Washington come, we will be having a conference of polluters. The COP17 will be renamed from Conference of the Parties of the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change to Conference of Polluters. So I think there will be steps taken in these capitals, and I'm pretty sure the activists in Ottawa are going to be making some strong statements saying, hey, should the Canadians actually show up? They're going to do much more harm than good, and that's the right sort of questioning to be putting out to the society.
I think that Stephen Harper, and this is just my opinion, works for the tar sands industry in Canada, so perhaps it's better he doesn't come from his record here. Well, you know, it's interesting you raised the idea of whether Kyoto will continue or not. Speaking at a climate justice seminar in Johannesburg, South Africa last week, Bernadinas Müller, the chief negotiator for the G77 developing country, said, and I quote, "Durban will not be the burial ground of the Kyoto Protocol." What do you think?
I think it probably will be, and it's simply because they may put some little bandage in place, but the real commitments to make those emission cuts by, you know, really come into effect by the end of 2012 so that we get a new round won't be there. And the carbon trading sort of strategies will. Those are the ones that in the World Bank is pushing in the Cannes G20 meeting to get all sorts of guarantees to keep these markets, which are failing. You know, they've sort of peaked at about $140 billion a year, and they need all kinds of subsidies and bailouts to keep them going when the Kyoto Protocol fails. And that's going to be the worst of all worlds, I think, Alex. That'll be, as you say, the real money that you need for paying the climate debt for a big green climate fund, which would be grants from the rich countries, isn't available. The austerity programs across certainly the U.S. and Europe just will not permit the finance ministries and the politicians to start paying their overdue climate debt, given the political balance of forces there. And so I think we're really going to see just a failure on all fronts in Durban, and that will mean that what we do outside as civil society and maybe uncivil society becomes all the more important.
Yes, Patrick Bond, will there be room for NGOs and interested citizens to participate? And I mean room in both the physical sense at the Durban site and when it comes to the civil rights ability to protest there in South Africa.
It is a very good question because on other occasions the police have acted in a reprehensible way, and we've had even in South Africa this year public, well-publicized shootings of nonviolent protesters. The worst experience might have, though, have been in Copenhagen, where hundreds and hundreds, maybe over 1,000 people were kettled, were put into a freezing cold pen for more than 5 hours, and the police were found to have acted absolutely abysmally there and engaged in illegal arrests and all the rest of it. So I think what we've been trying to tell the Durban police, especially because of the traditions here in Durban that Mahatma Gandhi founded 100 years ago, Satyagraha, that is the truth force, sort of the sense that people will be willing to put their bodies on the line. That's the kind of tradition that Durban likes to brag about. Mahatma Gandhi was here until 1914. He took that set of tactics out to India to throw the British out. And so an extraordinary legacy that we have here in Durban of nonviolent civil disobedience. And in Ottawa, just weeks ago, 200 people practicing that same tradition against the tar sands, and 1,252 people arrested at the White House in late August, early September. So we have a lot of momentum to put pressure and to make sure that the police respect everyone's rights. We've seen in the last few days even major problems in Durban, like a huge explosion at the main petrol refinery here in South Durban that left over 100 school kids hospitalized at a close-by primary school, and that really has put a great attention. There was a big march to the gate of the front gate last Saturday, and I think the police are beginning to understand that people are really fed up with the way the fossil fuel industry is operating here, and I think that sort of sense from the community of electricity disconnections and major problems in environmental justice, really, for so many of us in South Durban, will lead to the sort of big protests. We expect December 3rd, a Saturday, to be a major march going by the U.S. Consulate, City Hall, the International Convention Center, possibly ending at the beach for a going-away party. Of course, the beach will be going away as the water rises. It's the most democratic place in South Africa, and we want to hold firm there and make sure that everyone's committed to putting bodies on the line to ensure that the polluters don't keep getting away with it.
Well, even though it looks rather bleak for a settlement at COP17, I think that we have to keep going because we can't let hope die. We really have no other choice. I think eventually, driven by horrible climate events, humans will have to meet, agree, and act, or we'll go extinct. And I remember, too, Patrick, the decades required by so many movements, the fight against slavery and apartheid took generations, and nobody had the luxury of giving up. So, Patrick Bond, what could we do now?
Well, I think we have to take the lead from those that are on the front lines, the coal face. They're doing a great job in places like West Virginia, trying to stop the blowing up of the mountaintops to get the coal, or in Richmond, California, near San Francisco, stopping Chevron's expansion. The tar sands, certainly one of the greatest struggles in that attempt to stop the pipeline, very, very important. And if you go down south to Quito, Ecuador, and you find the debates raging over the Amazon in Ecuador, whether the oil can be left in the soil. You go across to Britain, major protests continuing there. Niger Delta, the oil in the soil is really the point of all sorts of activism of the Niger Delta environmentalists and community activists. And I think all over the world, one could go on and on, and even in like Norway, they just had a great victory in leaving oil in the soil, keeping the fracking in gas left in the earth in Quebec, for example, in New York State, in Pittsburgh, and in France. These are tremendous victories that activists are winning. And so, you know, we just need a lot more momentum, a lot more people to understand the crucial importance of joining the struggle, and not just saying we don't want the existing fossil fuels to continue, but we really need a huge new system of energy and transport and production and consumption that will move us away from a big corporate-run, for-profit mentality with overconsumption and our humanity destroyed by, you know, alienation in the process, and to a much more humane system. The Bolivians call that buen vivir, right? So we're really looking towards a transformation of the human sensibility to something that's a much higher stage. I think we can do it, and we don't have much more than a decade, but all the trends are that you can't stay on the current system, and we're going to have to make that change either with great pain and wars and economic crises or through some visionary activities, and that's what I'm seeing all over the world if you just look closely enough. I'm sure you see the same too, Alex.
I do. This is Radio EcoShock. Our guest has been Professor Patrick Bond from the University of KwaZulu-Natal in Durban, South Africa. Find a link to his Wikipedia page and other useful information in our show blog at ecoshock.info. Patrick, thank you so much for sharing your personal valuable time with us. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
On November 28th, the alleged leaders of the world gather to give themselves permission to keep pouring out more greenhouse gases into our atmosphere. Maybe they will make money with carbon trading schemes. Maybe they will plot to darken the sun with geoengineering. The people who live in Durban have other ideas. Here's Bongani Matembu from the South Durban Community Environmental Alliance, courtesy of a World Development Movement video.
I'm really appealing to civil society, to NGOs here in the UK, to lobby and make sure to come together and unite with us in solidarity in making sure that the government of UK is actually stopping its finance that is going via the World Bank, because it's not helping our countries, it's not helping the continent, and it's not helping the planet. Yeah, running up to Durban, we've been having a number of community workshops, you know, trying to build the awareness and making sure that the people, they see the need of them being involved, you know, because this will be a huge, you know, it will be a global conference. So we have seen that our government during last year, during the World Cup, even a four-year-old, it was indoctrinated in their head that the World Cup is coming. You know, the government made sure that the hype is there, you know, through the media and so forth and so forth. But now it's actually a different case now since the COP is coming to Durban, you know. Government is not actually publicizing and not bringing that awareness to communities like how they did with the World Cup. We really mean business, you know. As civil society, as activists, as environmental justice activists, we really mean business, you know. We're actually experiencing climate change. It's happening now, but it's something we actually need a change, you know. We need it from yesterday, so we need change now. They really need to commit themselves in changing their world for the better. Countries like the UK, they have to pay for the debts that they have actually put in our countries, you know. Like, for instance, you know, they've been benefiting from the global south. Since they have been benefiting from the global south, they should be paying the debts, you know. Not issuing climate loans, they should be actually compensating those countries rather than paying loans. So we are totally against the word of loans, because that means they are actually putting us in more debts. That has been a major, huge problem back in the country, not only in the country, but in the continent as a whole. Because we have seen that Madupi is one of the biggest dirty coal power stations that has been built in South Africa, that has been funded by the World Bank. And we know that the UK government has been putting money via the World Bank. And we are saying that the UK government needs to stop that, because apparently the World Bank has been saying that they want to fight poverty and reduce poverty. But with them funding such projects like Madupi and Kusile, that means it's actually they are contradicting with their statement. Because that is actually making the poverty queues more longer by them funding this unsustainable development. It's actually affecting them huge due to that they have to pay high tariffs of electricity, of which the same multi-corporation national from the global north, they are paying way, way cheap rather than an ordinary people. Like, for instance, the BHP pellets and the Anglo-American, they are paying 12 cents per kilowatt. Yet an ordinary person, that some of them, they are unemployed. We are talking about pensioners here. They are paying 28 cents per kilowatt. So can you see that there's a huge monopoly that is actually happening there, of which we are totally against.
I
corporate interests, you know, we see that in most of the UN talks, they tend to have the upper hand. They tend to have the last say because we believe that the corporation, they can lobby governments. So at the end of the day, it's their decision, you know. We can say the governments, you know, they decide, oh, we need to put a stop in the corporation making the decisions for our countries. It should be the ordinary citizens that actually making decisions for themselves rather than the big business guys, because they only think about profit. For them, it's profit before people. So we need to say it's people before profit.
Bongani seems right in touch with the Occupy London protesters in St. Paul's and around the world. From London, I spoke with Murray Worth, policy analyst for the World Development Movement. Even as Europe struggles with impossible financial problems, the situation is worse for developing countries. They are also loaded with decades of debt while they struggle to emerge from poverty into the modern world. That is the background for the upcoming climate talks in Durban, South Africa, starting in late November. At least $100 billion has been pledged to help countries in the South cope with climate change while establishing basic energy needs. The climate talks, in other words, cannot be separated from the economy. We reached Murray Worthy of the World Development Movement in London. Murray, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks for having me on.
Could you briefly describe your organization for our listeners?
Yeah, certainly. I work for the World Development Movement, which is a UK-based anti-poverty organization. We're a campaigning organization. Unlike others, we don't provide aid. We simply campaign on the policies of the UK and other rich industrialized countries that end up keeping poorer communities in poverty.
And WDM just hosted a tour of 8 talks in the UK by 2 South African activists. Tell us about the representative from the Shack Dwellers movement.
Yep, we had Bandile over from Abashlali, which is a shack dwellers movement in South Africa. They're quite an incredible movement that came out of a series of protests around the number of people that live in shack communities in South Africa. They work to oppose forced evictions from their shack communities, but also to provide basic services like healthcare, education, and electricity to their communities. For example, in South Africa, around over 40% of people don't actually have access to electricity in their homes. But in terms of the climate talks, they're part of a big society movement that's going to be organizing outside of the conference, educating people in South Africa about climate change and making sure those people's voices are being heard.
And your other guest was from the South Durban Community Environmental Alliance. What are Durban activists saying about the upcoming COP17 climate conference?
I mean, there are two real messages they're pushing, really. I mean, the first is about the South African government. When South Africa hosted the World Cup, well, it was really well heard about within South Africa. Everyone knew that it was coming. Whereas now with this climate conference, it's not really known about at all. And the South African government aren't listening to the people. Instead, it's the interests of large multinational corporations that are being heard. So what they're trying to push for is to get the voices of communities and of local people heard by the South African government. But also for the talks themselves, they're looking for a just deal, a fair deal that puts the needs of communities over those of big businesses and looks to rich industrialized countries to actually cut our emissions, to accept our historic responsibility for having caused climate change, and also to pay adequate compensation to countries in the developing world to help them with the impacts of climate change, and also, as you said, to meet their energy needs without them having to rely on coal and other fossil fuels, which we know is no longer sustainable.
I understand there are further actions planned, including a climate caravan. What is happening and what is the message?
So there's a climate caravan that's been organized that's quite incredible. It's going sort of halfway across the African continent, starting in Burundi and ending up in South Africa. And its two main goals are really to educate people along its way about climate change. There's still less awareness in some parts of climate change and what's happening with the UN process. But also it's about getting people's voices heard in a process that's been quite co-opted by corporate interests. It's about taking messages from those communities and taking them to the talks. And also using the caravan and this space outside of the summit to get a clear sense of what people are calling for, what the alternatives are to what we're seeing debated in the United Nations. I mean, one of the big things that's going to be happening is an international day of action for the World Bank to get out of climate finance. So that's the World Bank, which, you know, is a massive international financial institution, which is largely discredited in the global south, to stop playing such an enormous role in delivering climate finance.
Yeah, it's one of the big stumbling blocks. According to your website, 80% of climate funding from the UK is going through the World Bank. There must be a better way to do that.
Definitely. I mean, one of the reasons why climate finance is so important is because it's about building trust between developing and developed countries. For over 10 years now, developed countries have been pledging that they'll give money to help communities in the global south to deal with the impacts of climate change and reduce their emissions. But really, we've seen very little progress so far on that. And for example, as you said, the UK is giving around 80% of its finance through the World Bank. Now, the problem with that is the World Bank is an inherently undemocratic organization. It was set up after the Second World War and essentially gives the richest nations the most power. Instead of each country having a say, the richest countries have a say. It's also played a key role in causing climate change, in financing enormous fossil fuel industries, mining and logging, and actually has caused this problem. It's got no place in trying to tackle it. Even in the last few years in South Africa, it approved over $4 billion for a new coal-fired power station. It's clearly not the right institution for solving climate change. And also, fundamentally, the World Bank is a lending institution. That's what it does. It lends money. But climate finance should be being given. It shouldn't be given as loans, which then developing countries lock them into further debt, which they then have to repay. So the World Bank's a completely discredited institution for giving climate finance.
Right, and there is lots of talk about solving the climate crisis with more capitalist tools. It should all be done by private companies, and there should be a carbon market with a trading scheme. That all seems to be part of these UN climate negotiations. Is that working?
No, I mean, looking at carbon trading particularly, I mean, when that was first put forward, it was seen as a kind of just a little add-on, something that could help make the process easier. Whereas now it's taken the point where it's become kind of center stage as like the key tool to tackle climate change. But carbon trading is fundamentally flawed because, firstly, it basically places the burden for reducing emissions back on communities in the developing countries and gives rich industrialized countries like the UK or the US the right to continue emitting at the rate that we have done before. So therefore, it takes the pressure off us to actually be doing what we should be doing, which is cutting emissions. Secondly, there's no guarantee that the things that are being traded are actually, that there are genuine emissions reductions taking place. A lot of the time, there's real questions around how much is actually being saved, and yet that is being used to justify more emissions elsewhere. And also, very little money actually goes through to the projects that are supposed to benefit from them. Less than 1% of the money that goes through these carbon markets actually goes to the project that's supposed to be reducing emissions. The rest just gets taken up by accountants and project managers and other people on the chain. So carbon trading's completely failing to tackle this problem, yet increasingly desperate rich countries are relying on this to tackle the problem.
And that's just the sort of scheme that got us into the financial mess that we're in with the European banks.
Exactly, and it's something we're seeing more and more, is the same kind of financial logic that underpinned the financial system before the financial crisis is now being sort of moved into climate change, into a place where there's no place for that. There's no room for risk. We know what we need to do. We need to cut emissions. We know how far and by how much. But the point is that countries just aren't willing to do that. They aren't willing to do what science tells them they'll do, and they're now clutching at straws to try and find a way out of that.
Murray Worthy, I'm sad to see that my own country, Canada, has joined Russia and Japan in saying the Kyoto Protocol is dead in 2012 and must stay that way. Without any binding agreement, your organization suggests, or we could be heading up to 5 degrees Celsius, and that's an absolute catastrophe for the world and especially for Africa. Is there a better way? What should we be doing?
I think the Kyoto Protocol is the way out of this. Just 4 years ago, all the countries, including the US, Canada, everyone sat down in Bali and said, right, what are we going to do? And they came up with a fairly simple plan, which is by the end of this year, all the countries who are party to Kyoto, so that includes Canada, Japan, and Russia, commit to further emissions reductions. America, because it never signed Kyoto, would make similar emissions reductions. And the developing countries would work to reduce their emissions when supported by finance and technology from developed countries, taking into account the fact that those countries are dealing with getting, as you said at the start, getting their people out of poverty, they don't have the resources that countries like America or Canada or the UK do. So they've got to provide resources to help them tackle it. And that framework was agreed just 4 years ago. And yet now we're seeing countries like Canada, America, trying to walk away from this and essentially just completely undermining any chance of getting a real deal on climate change. And without Kyoto, we are looking at something like 5 degrees from the kind of current voluntary pledges. And that's even if those voluntary pledges are met. There's no reason why these kind of voluntary targets would actually, there's nothing binding to force those countries to meet them. So without that, there's no guarantee that we can avoid the kinds of catastrophic climate change that really would be devastating, not just for people in developing countries, but would actually have really serious impacts on communities in Europe and North America as well.
Is the UK holding up its end with the new Cameron government?
The new Cameron government, before it came in, pledged that it would be the greenest government ever and is currently busy sort of giving up on every single promise that it made. Recently, the Chancellor, George Osborne, came out and said that we would do no more than anyone else in Europe, completely going back on the historic Climate Change Act that was passed a couple of years ago that put binding targets into law. So no, I mean, the Cameron government's really falling back on its pledges, and we're quite worried that they're going to keep dropping their targets ahead of Durban this year.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. We're hashing through the upcoming United Nations Climate Conference in Durban, South Africa. From London, our guest is Murray Worthy, policy analyst for the World Development Movement. Thank you, Murray, and good luck.
Thank you.
I'm Alex Smith. Before we talk with a new media activist in San Francisco, let's hear just a minute from another Durban voice, Bandelisi Madilosi. We need to understand Durban is already occupied. Like most African cities, and in fact most countries of the world, there is a community of people living in shacks. No electricity, no sewage, no safe running water. The police arrive only to evict them. World Development brought Bandili for an 8-city tour of the UK this fall to help raise awareness of the realities of Durban as the COP17 climate talks fast approach.
We are shack dwellers. We live in a shack dwellers, so we need to call ourselves Abasali Basemjondo, which means shack dwellers. We live in shacks. The reason I got involved, some say that I'm a born leader, but it's the very same reasons why the organization was formed. We live in a shack at home, and then there's no service deliveries, and we're facing a lot of eviction, you know. So that's the reason I felt like I need to help my parents through this. I need to also be part and parcel of it. You learn that it's not only you who's facing that. It's like everyone who's facing that, and that's what keeps us going. You know, in the COP17, it's only ministers, academics, scientists, big NGOs, you know, all those big corporates. Those are the ones that allowed inside the COP17. And for civil society organizations, only those few individuals that can apply and go there as an observer. So we felt like this is not enough, because automatically if they're going there, there's no much big voice that they can carry inside. This is not the time for the government to take decisions for the people, but it's the time for the people to take decisions for themselves. So the struggle continues. It's a long struggle. Our former president, Nelson Mandela, said that it's a long walk to freedom. And even to ourselves, it's a long walk to freedom.
That was Bandili Madilosi, a leader of the Durban Shack Dwellers Movement, courtesy of a video from the World Development Movement website at wdm.org.uk. Now to San Francisco. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. So often at climate events, I find a sea of gray heads, they're all nodding, and not enough young people who will be hit hardest by climate change. But young people are out there, they are organizing and communicating using all sorts of new media. Today, we'll talk with Madeline Kovacs, the co-coordinator of the Project Survival Media, and I'd like to welcome you to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you very much, Alex. It's wonderful to be here.
Madeline, tell us about your project.
So Project Survival Media was basically born out of the international youth climate movement that coalesces around the international negotiations to fight for a fair and binding treaty that will secure a future for all people on the planet that basically will ensure that we're able to survive and thrive on the planet. It's funny that you, in your introduction, you know, you mentioned that at climate conferences and climate events, it's a sea of gray heads, and I think that is unfortunately a lot of the time very, very true. However, my experience at the international negotiations is that young people from all over the world are forming relationships across country lines, across cultural lines, and we all understand that our future is very much at stake. And we also understand that our futures are tied together with every other person and every other young person on the planet. And the conversations that arise from that are so much more powerful and forward-looking and sort of like ready to leave behind this old jargon of statistics and targets that we usually talk about in the media with regards to climate change. We're ready to get our hands dirty, build the solutions that we need to see. And so Project Survival Media was born out of that. You know, we absolutely recognize that people on the planet are already suffering because of climate change right now to the degree that their survival is at stake. And the mission of the project is to lift up those voices and perspectives that you mentioned are very underreported and underrepresented in the climate conversation and give people the chance to share their stories about how climate change is affecting them, but also what their community is doing about it and to share the solutions that they're finding. So that is our mission. We train youth journalists, writers, photographers, and videographers to create news content around the front lines of climate change. Who are the most impacted people? How is climate change affecting them? But even more importantly, how are they adapting and mitigating climate change? They're doing it already. They're doing it right now, and their stories need to be shared.
So we're not just talking about a North American viewpoint. You're getting people in other parts of the world as part of this.
Yeah, absolutely. So the way we operate is it is coordinated centrally. The founder and my co-coordinator, Shadia Fain Wood, and I are based in Berkeley, California, and housed with the Earth Island Institute. But the way that we operate is we seek out talent and then assemble media teams in different countries all over the world. So we're a global organization, and basically that enables that media team to focus really locally on the local issues, on a narrative that's going to speak to people locally about what's going on. But hopefully that narrative will also translate and be a really good educational moment for, you know, a North American audience that isn't used to seeing a video produced by a youth in India. So we really work with people locally to train more youth journalists to report in a very intelligent, specific way on the front lines of the climate crisis.
Well, Radio EcoShock has just reported on how very important what's happening in India can be. Tell us about your new team there.
Well, sure. We're really excited to announce we just launched our Team India about 2 months ago. And this team is part of a program called Solutions for Survival. So we kind of have two distinct programs, one being our presence at the United Nations and reporting on stories from the UN. The other is Solutions for Survival, which is basically a new media series designed to deal with the reality that people are already experiencing climate change, and as our international and governmental systems of leadership are failing to provide people with the solutions that they need as quickly as they need them, that people are finding their own climate solutions, and there's incredible resiliency in communities. Basically, our media teams are focusing on solutions areas across like a really wide range, from urban planning to women's empowerment to water use to sustainable agriculture. Like, what's scary but also really fortunate about climate change as an issue is that there are lots of little solutions, and they all need to happen and be shared at once. Team India is going to focus on different solutions areas in India and how people are addressing climate change, and the goal being that, you know, they create content, whether it's a video or a photo essay, like it's really engaging visual media that hits you very, very hard because these are real people being impacted by climate change. It's not just about facts or statistics. It's about the narrative of this person who has recently experienced food insecurity because largely of climate change and the effects that their region is experiencing. But it's more than that. It's the story of how they're adapting, how people are finding solutions, and our goal is that when someone watches our media, if you're a person in the U.S., you are educated, you are moved, and you are totally inspired by these climate solutions you're seeing. But if you're someone else in India or another developing country that has maybe a similar climactic, is in a similar geography, and you're experiencing these same effects of climate change already, then you not only are moved, you also have a place to begin in action and take this media piece and be able to start implementing a similar solution in your area. And so that's really our goal, is to create a catalog and a library of all these different climate solutions, but that are very accessible to people because they're engaging visual human stories. So it's really a very grassroots project. That's what our India team is up to, and we went through a very rigorous application and interview process, and our videographers, our editors, our photographers, our writers, and our team leader are all absolutely amazing. If you go to our website, www.projectsurvivalmedia.org, we just put up a welcome to the team, and people can read the biographies of all of our team members, and we'll be sharing some exciting videos soon, so we're really excited about it.
And the beauty of it is, with this new technology, you can get some HD video right out of a phone even, so that what used to cost $100,000 for a camera, that shut out a lot of people. Those people are back now with this new technology. I noticed that Project Survival Media has some really interesting people on the mentorship board. It's a mixture of activists and storytellers and filmmakers, a couple of whom I recognize. Can you tell us just a couple of people who are there?
Sure. I'll give you a couple of highlights of some folks that we've just been so happy to have on board and have been so helpful. The first one's Christian Ettinger. He's wonderful. He's done a number of things. He's been a reporter. He's worked on documentaries. He's worked in environmental philanthropy for quite a while. And he and his wonderful wife, Clarice, actually hosted our first house party. So part of what we are so privileged to have a board that helps us do is basically Shadi and I are both 24. Actually, I just turned 25 yesterday, but we're both young. And so when you go to launch a project like this, it is absolutely critical to have a group of more experienced adults and people who have professional backgrounds who are really invested in seeing your program succeed. So Christian has been so wonderful. He's one of those people. Another is Anisha Desai. She's the director of the New Leaders Initiative and the Brower Youth Awards at the Earth Island Institute, which is, of course, one of the most prestigious awards for young people working on environmental issues here in the United States. And another person I'll highlight that recently came on board is Josh Fox, who directed Gasland, which was, nominated for a 2011 Oscar. That's about the dangers of fracking. So he's kind of jumped onto the scene with this film in terms of a really long-form environmental documentary. So we're really excited to have his kind of narrative expertise.
Madeline, I want to say there was a lot of despair after that wishy-washy, I'm going to call it a failure, at Copenhagen last year. And yet your group is still planning to do something at the Durban United Nations COP17 climate negotiations. Those start up in South Africa November 28th. Why should people still hope for anything out of this United Nations process?
Yeah, I think that's an excellent question. And I know that is a question that we have been asking ourselves ever since the Copenhagen Agreement in 2009. I mean, we were devastated. We came home and, 6 months later, I was still depressed about it because I think there was such a surge in 2009 and then kind of such a letdown for the global community and for the people on the front lines of climate change right now. It was devastating. I don't think we are going to see a meaningful agreement internationally that is the solid plan of action that the globe needs to truly tackle climate change and get binding commitments from key economies in 2011. I don't think that's what we're going to see. Something that did come out of 2009, though, that it took a longer time to see and to realize was the enormous groundswell of citizen participation and grassroots action and kind of networking and awareness that came out of 2009 in terms of maybe we don't wait for our governments to come up with the plans of action that we need. Maybe it's going to be much more distributed, much more regional, much more local, and maybe this is an opportunity for us to plant the seeds and lay the groundwork for the kind of world that we want to live in. Now, that being said, that still, in my mind, leaves a bit of a scary gap between how fast we can see the kind of global change that we need and the kind of cuts in carbon emissions that we need. but civil society at the negotiations has been so much better about being inclusive and about making sure that most impacted peoples, like least developed countries, indigenous peoples, small island states, youth, those people have been almost shut out of the negotiation process. I mean, you saw groups of countries get together in 2009 and 2010 and really put the pressure on as much as they could in some ways. But to us, we can't get depressed by the lack of a perfect treaty and international action. When we go to Durban this year, Project Survival Media's mission will be to focus on those most impacted peoples and on those peoples that not only are most impacted, but also hold a lot of the solutions for how we as a globe are going to tackle climate change. We partner with NGOs and with media outlets because our content is covering perspectives that no one else is covering, that no one else is giving the kind of attention to and the kind of really critical questions like, okay, for your community, you know, 10 years out, what does this theoretical decision actually mean for you on the ground? We feel like we're able to hold the movement's feet to the fire and keep a lot of people honest in terms of making sure that they're still talking about equity and that they're still talking about survival and that they are still talking about climate change as a very, very human issue when the play-by-play gets started and we all start talking about tons of carbon. And
well, this could be a kind of launching platform and an organizing thing. You're going to make more connections from people all over the world who do care. And I'm thinking of the Occupy Wall Street movement. Maybe this is a time for the Occupy Durban movement, where all those voices that are left outside the walls, and especially youth, get a chance to break through a little bit and to report back. And while the spotlight is there, as lazy as the media can be, we'll try and make up for some of those holes. I'd like to hear some of the things that you're putting together that we could broadcast on Radio EcoShock. I think we could work together on that.
Definitely. We'd be happy to do that, both in terms of interviews and also in terms of, we'll see at the negotiations what sorts of really pivotal stories emerge. We already know there are a few beats, specific beats, we're definitely going to be covering within kind of what I've been talking about, one being the whole discussion about RED, which is the kind of forestry sub-agreement that people have been talking about. And I think that's going to get a lot of pushback from indigenous communities because their land rights are basically being forfeited and basically forests are allowed to be bartered for carbon offsetting in a way that disenfranchises people who have lived there for hundreds of years. So that's the kind of issue that we try to bring to the forefront. We're excited to work with you.
How can young people hearing this right now get involved to set up their own climate survival media teams?
They can go to the website, projectsurvivalmedia.org, and they can send an email to either Shadia or myself. They can sign up to our newsletter to stay involved. And if they are interested in starting a media team, we do have a kind of search and then interview and process that we go through that's very formal to set up a media team, and a lot of it depends on funding and the talent we're able to find in different areas. But they should absolutely sign up to our newsletter, and they should absolutely send Shadi or I an email and introduce themselves and what they're passionate about and their skill sets or someone they know. You know, we love to hear from youth all over the country and all over the world who are really passionate about solving climate change.
You've been listening to Madeline Kovacs, the co-coordinator of the Project ProjectSurvivalMedia.org. We'll be keeping in tune with their productions here on Radio EcoShock. Madeline, thank you for talking with us, and thanks for keeping up the good fight for a survivable climate.
Oh, thank you very much, Alex. It was a pleasure. I'll talk to you again soon.
I'm Alex Smith. I am your host, Alex Smith. Write me. The address, radio@ecoshock.org. Our website is www.ecoshock.org. Thank you for listening. We leave with a song for the Occupy movement, Change, Change, by the Canadian singer known only as Thistle.